So to start off this deep dive, I want you to just picture a massive political blowout.
Yeah.
Like in 2024, Kamala Harris lost the state of Kentucky by 30 points.
Oh, yeah. It wasn't even close. Just a total blowout.
Right. But then you look at just 1 year prior, 2023, and a Democrat actually won that exact same state by 5 points.
Which is, I mean, mathematically wild when you stop and think about
It
it.
really is. I mean, we're living in this deeply divided country, right? Where everyone supposedly just votes strictly down these rigid party lines.
Yeah, that's the conventional wisdom anyway.
Exactly. So how in the world do you explain a 35-point swing in the exact same electorate in 12 months?
That is the million-dollar question.
And that's exactly what we're getting into today. We are looking under the hood of this very specific political machine. We've got this massive, totally impartial data report from the American newspaper and American TV.
Yeah, it's a really comprehensive look at Andy Beshear, the governor of Kentucky, and his potential for a 2028 presidential run.
Right. And the mission today is to see if his highly customized local formula could actually be scaled up to, manufacture a 270 electoral vote national win.
Which is a huge leap. Going from Kentucky to the national stage is no joke.
It's a massive leap. But before we really tear into the numbers, we have to do our mandatory disclaimer for you all listening.
Yes, very important. We need to be crystal clear here.
We are not taking sides today. We aren't endorsing any candidates. And we are absolutely not pushing any sort of left-wing or right-wing agenda.
No, not at all. Our job is strictly to just impartially report on the verified facts, the polling data, and the scenarios that are laid out in this source document.
Exactly. We're treating this entirely as a neutral mathematical case study in modern election mechanics.
Just looking at the raw blueprint.
Right. So let's unpack that blueprint. If someone actually wants to scale a local anomaly into a national presidency, you kind of have to start by figuring out how the anomaly happened in the first place.
You do. And to really understand Bashir's political DNA, you have to go back to 2019. That's how he first got the governor's mansion.
Okay, so he was the state attorney general then, right?
Yeah.
And the son of a former governor, Steve Beshear.
Yeah, exactly. But his 2019 race against the Republican incumbent, a guy named Matt Bevin, it wasn't this like grand ideological awakening in a deep red state.
No. What was it then?
It was a razor-thin victory that was almost entirely driven by local grievance. I mean, Matt Bevin had spent years just actively antagonizing teachers and public employees.
Oh, right. This was over the state pensions, wasn't it?
Yes,
Yeah.
specifically the pensions. And he made it incredibly personal. So Beshear didn't win by, convincing conservatives to suddenly become liberals.
So it was more of a protest vote against the incumbent.
Exactly. He capitalized on a highly specific, localized frustration with Bevin's personality and governance style. And even then, he only won by just over 5,000 votes.
Wow, 5,000 votes. That's like, what, a margin of 0.36%?
Yeah, it was practically a rounding error.
Okay, so I'm trying to wrap my head around this. It's kind of like a sports team that usually just gets totally crushed in a specific stadium, right?
I love a sports analogy. Go for it.
Well, they figure out this highly tailored game plan to just barely survive the away games so that their star players at home can secure the overall win.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense for 2019. It was entirely a protest vote against the other guy.
But you can't build a national brand on just being not Matt Bevin, right? Which brings us to his 2023 re-election against Daniel Cameron.
Right, and that race was a totally different story. That was not a squeaker at all.
No, he won by over 67,000 votes that time, like a 5.1-point margin.
Yeah, he held onto these huge urban margins, like 70% in Louisville and 72% in Lexington.
But the crazy part is, he actually improved his standing in the suburbs and the rural counties. How does he pull that off once he actually has a record to defend?
Well, it comes down to something political scientists call the office effect.
The office effect?
Yeah. When a voter in a red state looks at a Democratic governor, they're evaluating them purely on local executive function. Like, did you pave my roads?
Oh, okay. Like, did you handle the disaster release well?
Exactly. Did you manage the recovery after the floods in eastern Kentucky? Did you bring a new battery plant to my county?
So they aren't looking at him as a national political figure.
No, a rural conservative voter can happily vote for him to manage the state budget because they don't view him as a threat to their national cultural
They're
values.
splitting their ticket based on the job description.
Precisely. And this is the big catch that raises a massive psychological wall.
What do you mean?
Well, that crossover appeal you see in a local executive race, it does not automatically translate into a permanent partisan shift.
Oh, I see. Because handing someone the keys to the state highway department is very different from handing them the nuclear codes.
Right. Or the authority to appoint Supreme Court justices. It's a totally different risk profile for the voter.
Which means we really need to examine what his actual political brand is underneath all the road paving and disaster management.
Definitely. Because if that local crossover appeal is so tied to his personal vibe, we need to know how he sounds versus how he actually governs.
And looking at the report data, his style is just this masterclass in cultural de-escalation.
It really is. He talks relentlessly about pocketbook federalism, you know, jobs, bridges, EV manufacturing.
And he wraps it all in this very specific moral language, too. I mean, he and his wife are deacons at their Christian church.
Yes, and he constantly defaults to the phrase, love your neighbor. That vocabulary is basically his superpower in a red state.
But you really have to separate that neighborly tone from his actual legislative substance, right?
You do, because if you just listen to his tone, you might assume he's this, like, 1990s Bill Clinton-style centrist.
Like someone who constantly triangulates and throws his own progressive base under the bus to appease conservatives.
Exactly. But if you look at his veto pen, it tells a totally different story.
Yeah, I was looking at that. He vetoed sweeping anti-abortion restrictions.
Right. And he vetoed anti-LGBTQ legislation that targeted transgender minors. He vetoed anti-union bills.
He expanded Medicaid and publicly backed red flag gun laws, too.
Yeah, so on paper, his substance is very center-left.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting to me. If he's vetoing all these conservative social bills and backing standard progressive policies. I mean, he literally has the backing of major national unions like the UAW and the AFL-CIO.
He does.
So isn't he just a traditional national Democrat wearing a moderate costume?
Well, that's the tension, right?
Because when he steps onto a national debate stage, won't his opponents just read that list of vetoes and immediately rip off that moderate label?
That's a huge risk. But what's fascinating here is how he survives doing this in Kentucky without getting voted out.
How does he do it?
He uses his tone as a shield. When he vetoes a controversial cultural bill, he doesn't hold a massive press conference and give some fiery partisan speech about left-wing values.
Right. He doesn't go viral on purpose.
No, he steps up to the podium and talks like a regional manager just trying to keep the peace.
Wow.
He frames these issues around individual liberty, preventing government overreach, and keeping the state open for business.
He literally calls himself a pragmatist and a pro-business Democrat.
Yes. And he points to the $50 billion with a B dollars in private investment he's helped bring into the state.
So by maintaining this really low-temperature rhetoric, he essentially takes a high-conflict national culture war and turns it into a boring local administrative task.
Exactly. He makes the controversy boring. And that is how he makes standard center-left policies palatable to voters who would normally never vote for a national Democrat.
That is fascinating. But, I mean, here's the massive structural problem I see with all of this.
The primary.
Yeah. Having a unique, low-temperature de-escalation brand only matters if you can actually survive the Democratic primary to get to the general election.
And the primary is a brutal ideological sorting mechanism.
Let's look at the calendar reality check here. Because as the report notes, the DNC completely rewired the primary calendar in August of 2026.
They completely threw out the old playbook. Iowa is just entirely gone from the early window.
Right. So what does the new gauntlet look like?
Well, it starts with South Carolina on January 22nd.
Okay.
Then it moves to Nevada on February 1st. New Hampshire on February 8th, New Mexico on February 15th, Michigan on February 22nd, and Virginia on February 29th.
So think about what that sequence actually tests for a candidate.
It's testing completely different coalitions back to back.
Right. You are testing a candidate's appeal with black voters in South Carolina right out of the gate, then Latinos and organized labor in Nevada.
And then you eventually get to suburbanites in Virginia.
So if your entire political superpower is winning white working class voters in the rural Midwest, isn't starting the primary in South Carolina just, I don't know, brutal?
Because the Democratic base there is overwhelmingly black.
Yeah. It's like showing up for a marathon and finding out the first 5 miles are a swimming segment.
That is a great way to put it. And it is the single most dangerous bottleneck for his entire campaign theory.
Because he doesn't have a record there.
He has absolutely no demonstrated national minority voter base. In Kentucky, winning over large percentages of black and Latino voters simply isn't the primary demographic hurdle you have to clear to win statewide.
Right. the demographics just aren't the same.
So he is completely untested in the environments that now define the first month of a presidential primary.
Does he know this? I mean, he has to, right?
Oh, he absolutely knows this. He's making efforts to build that credibility on the fly.
Like traveling as the chair of the Democratic Governors Association.
Yeah, and he's made some really high-profile speaking appearances at places like the National Action Network. But the thing is, building organic trust with key demographic voting blocks takes years, not months.
Right. So the very real risk is that he simply gets eliminated in those early states before he ever reaches a state that actually fits his resume.
Because Michigan sits on February 22nd.
Yes. And Michigan is the state that is perfectly 100% aligned with his pro-labor manufacturing Midwestern brand.
If he could just start the race in Michigan, he'd be a juggernaut.
But he has to survive the swimming segment to get to the running track.
Exactly. And the primary process is a rigid sequential filter. You cannot skip to the states that like you.
So he has to clear South Carolina with at least enough delegate credibility to stay viable.
Right. And if he makes it to Michigan, then his working class executive governor profile suddenly transforms into a massive asset.
But surviving those first few weeks requires convincing voters who really don't know you and who don't share your geographic background that you're the safest long-term bet for the party.
Which is incredibly hard to do from a standing start.
Okay, let's play this out. Let's say he performs a political miracle and actually survives that primary obstacle course.
Okay, assuming he gets the nomination.
Right. The ultimate test is the Electoral College. This is where his Kentucky strategy actually has to translate into national math.
And looking at the pathways to 270 electoral votes, there is really only one realistic route for a Democrat right now.
And that is the blue wall path.
Yes. You start with the 226 electoral votes that Kamala Harris secured in 2024.
Okay.
Then you absolutely have to add Pennsylvania with its 19 votes, Michigan with its 15, and Wisconsin with its 10.
You add those up and you hit exactly 270.
Exactly. And this is where the core mathematical premise of a Beshear candidacy really comes into focus.
And the report calls this the losing rural by less strategy. Right?
Yes, losing rural by less. You have to fundamentally change how you view the electoral map.
Because you aren't trying to flip whole counties.
Right. To win the presidency, a Democrat does not need to go into rural deep red counties and turn them blue. They just need to stop the bleeding.
Let's put some hard numbers to that for everyone listening, because the math here is honestly staggering.
It really puts things in perspective.
If you look at the 2024 margins in those three blue wall states,
yep,
Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, to entirely reverse the outcome of that election, a Democrat would only have needed roughly 114,885 direct voter switches.
Across all three states combined.
Combined. And in Wisconsin specifically, the margin was so tight that it would have only taken 14,699 direct voter switches to flip the state.
And we really need to pause and define what a direct voter switch actually means mechanically, because it is the absolute secret to this entire strategy.
Right. What does that actually look like on the ground?
We aren't talking about knocking on doors and finding 14,000 brand new undecided voters who have never voted before.
Okay.
If you persuade just one rural Republican who voted red in the last election to vote Democratic this time, that takes one vote out of the Republican column and adds one vote to the Democratic column.
Oh, wow. So it's a two-vote swing in the final margin.
Yes. So when we say you need 14,000 switches, you only need to convince a fraction of the population to actually change their minds.
But you might be listening to this and wondering, can a guy from Kentucky really convince a rural farmer or a factory worker in Wisconsin to switch sides just because he has a nice resume?
That's a fair question.
After all, the data clearly states that Kentucky itself is purely symbolic in a presidential race.
Right. He's not going to win Kentucky's electoral votes in a national election. It will stay solid red.
So how does his background actually move the needle in the Midwest?
Well, the symbolism is the entire strategy. University of New Hampshire researchers actually ran the models on this.
And what did they find?
They found that even a mere 3-point improvement among rural voters completely rewires the national battleground map.
Just 3 points.
Just 3 points. Andy Beshear's biographical alignment with Appalachia and the Midwest is basically weaponized to generate that exact marginal gain.
Oh, I see. When he speaks, he doesn't sound like a coastal elite lecturing rural voters.
Right. He sounds like their local mayor. His focus on local infrastructure and supply chains is designed to make a rural voter in western Pennsylvania or northern Wisconsin feel comfortable crossing party lines.
just like they did in Kentucky.
Exactly. But, and this is a massive balancing act, he has to do that without depressing the massive urban turnout he absolutely needs in cities like Philadelphia, Detroit, or Milwaukee.
Right, because you can't lose the base while chasing the middle. But, you know, all of this brilliant electoral math only works if the candidate can actually execute a billion-dollar national campaign.
And under the most intense opposition scrutiny on the planet.
Which brings us to section 5 of the report.
Right.
The execution gaps. Because there are some glaring red flags here.
Yeah, let's start with name ID.
Yeah. An April 2026 poll from the Napolitan News Service showed that 57% of voters had either never heard of him or simply didn't know enough about him to even form an opinion.
And that is a tremendous structural disadvantage.
I mean, half the country doesn't know who you are.
Right. When you're running against national figures who have been on television every single day for a decade, starting from zero name recognition means you have to spend hundreds of millions of dollars just introducing yourself.
Just to get to baseline.
Yeah, before you can even begin to attack your opponent. And that leads directly to the second execution gap, the financial infrastructure.
Right, let's talk about the money. His hybrid PayPal is called In This Together.
Yep.
By mid-2026, it had raised about $3.3 million. But the donor base is incredibly concentrated.
It's extremely top-heavy.
In one specific IRS filing, 77% of the contributions came from just two individual donors.
Which is the exact opposite of what a modern presidential campaign needs to survive.
Because he completely lacks that mass, small-dollar digital grassroots army.
Exactly. The kind of operation that candidates like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Pete Buttigieg have spent years cultivating.
And when the primary schedule is as compressed as it is in 2028?
You need a massive financial engine. You have to sustain simultaneous ground operations across 5 different states.
Right.
Relying on a handful of wealthy donors or traditional party networks is incredibly brittle. If one major donor gets cold feet after a bad debate performance, the entire operation could just dry up overnight.
Wow. And speaking of debate performances, there's a massive hole in his resume that we have to talk about.
The foreign policy gap.
Right. He is the state governor. He has zero military service, zero diplomatic experience, and zero federal security background.
Which is a huge liability in a general election.
Which brings us to the hypothetical matchup we have to consider. If he faces the current 2026 GOP polling leader, J.D. Vance, the strategy is obvious.
Right. Vance would immediately try to nationalize the race.
He'd blame any inflation or economic turbulence entirely on national Democrats, and he would hammer Beshear on border policy.
Exactly, forcing him to defend the federal government's record. This really exposes the inherent asymmetry of experience when a governor steps onto a presidential debate stage.
Because a senator just inherently looks more federal.
Yeah. If you have a sitting vice president or a senator on one side, they can speak with direct institutional authority on federal enforcement, national security, global crises.
And a state governor simply does not have that muscle memory.
Not at all.
So picture this scenario for a second. He is standing on a debate stage under the hot lights against J.D. Vance.
Okay, setting the scene.
The moderators start throwing these complex, multi-layered questions about, you know, a nuclear Iran or China's posture toward Taiwan or NATO funding obligations.
Yeah.
Isn't he going to look like a regional manager who was suddenly asked to take over a global multinational corporation?
It's arguably his clearest vulnerability.
How does a governor from Kentucky answer a question about the South China Sea without sounding completely out of his depth?
Well, to survive those attacks, Beshear would have to immediately build a highly visible, incredibly credible advisory bench.
Like surrounding himself with experts.
Yes. He would need respected former generals and diplomats standing behind him to basically borrow their credibility.
But tactically, on that stage, in real time, what does he do?
He only has one real move. He has to relentlessly pivot every single foreign policy question back to domestic supply chains, energy resilience, and American manufacturing.
Oh, I see. So if the moderator asks about Taiwan microchips,
he has to pivot and talk about building semiconductor plants in Ohio and battery factories in Kentucky.
So he brings it back home.
Always.
Yeah.
He has to translate every abstract global issue into a tangible local economic impact, because that is literally the only terrain where he has actual executive proof of work.
Okay, let's synthesize all of this for you guys listening.
Mm-hmm.
Based on all the data and the mechanics we've unpacked today, there's a very specific, highly conditional winning formula for Andy Beshear.
There is, and it's a tight sequence.
Right. Step 1, He has to somehow clear South Carolina to prove to the party apparatus that he actually has black voter support and isn't just a regional favorite for rural white voters.
Right.
Step two, he has to hold the blue wall by losing rural by less in states like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, finding those 14,000 voters willing to switch sides.
Yeah, the direct voter switches.
Step three, he has to maintain that low-temperature, neighborly tone while simultaneously defending his vetoes on progressive social issues.
The tone is a shield.
Exactly.
Okay.
And step four, he has to somehow scale a concentrated local Kentucky PAC into a massive billion-dollar grassroots national infrastructure almost overnight.
Like we said, it is an incredibly delicate sequence. It is a tightrope walk.
And if any one of those fails.
Yeah, if he trips in South Carolina, or his funding dries up, or he looks lost on a foreign policy question, the entire pathway collapses instantly.
And for you listening right now, this is exactly why we wanted to take this deep dive today.
Because it's not just about one guy from Kentucky.
Exactly. Unpacking this blueprint is the perfect shortcut to seeing how national elections are truly won. It's not through viral tweets or cable news shouting matches or trending hashtags.
It's math.
It is grueling state-by-state coalition building and cold, hard demographic math. You have to locate 14,000 specific human beings in Wisconsin, understand their psychology, and give them a compelling reason to switch their vote.
All without accidentally alienating 14,000 people in Detroit in the process.
Right. It is mechanical work.
It is the ultimate balancing act. And, you know, there is a historical precedent in the report that really brings this entire theory back down to earth.
Oh, right. The Steve Bullock comparison. We have to look at that.
Yeah. If you look at the recent past, we've actually seen this exact playbook attempted before.
Yes. So for those who don't remember, Steve Bullock was a popular two-term Democratic governor from the deeply red state of Montana.
Very similar profile.
Right. And he tried to run in the 2020 presidential primary using this exact same blueprint. His
rural conservatives and win.
And he completely failed to gain any traction whatsoever. He barely made a blip on the radar, and the primary voters just weren't buying what he was selling.
Which really forces us to question the foundational assumption of the Andy Beshear strategy.
The idea that voters actually want calm.
Exactly. The entire theory, the tone, the pocketbook federalism, the de-escalation, it all relies on the idea that voters, at the end of the day, genuinely want a calm, pragmatic problem solver in the Oval Office.
And that brings us right back to our opening thought, looking under the hood of this massive political machine. We live in a highly nationalized, algorithm-driven political environment.
We really do.
The platforms we use every day actively reward high conflict, absolute ideological purity, and just constant daily outrage.
It's how you raise money and it's how you get attention.
Right. So here's the question we want to leave you with to mull over as you watch the 2028 cycle unfold. In today's hyper-polarized world, is the very concept of lower temperature, local competence actually a fatal disadvantage on the national stage?
It's a tough question to answer.
Do voters actually want the calm pragmatism they claim to desire in polls? Or is the chaotic noise of the storm the only thing they'll actually show up to vote for?
It really is the defining question of the era.
Thanks for taking the deep dive with us. See you next time.